Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Samuel Helfand and his book, Compulsion in Religion, Saddam Hussein, Islam, and the Roots of Insurgencies in Iraq. It's a fascinating book that is relevant not only to an understanding of Iraq, the resistance during the rule of Saddam Hussein, and the nature of the primarily religious resistance and insurgencies since the U.S. invasion in 2003 and Saddam Hussein's fall, but also, more fundamentally, to the relationship between the state and religion in autocratic and illiberal countries, something that plays out in multiple countries today, including Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Samuel Helfand, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to have you. I enjoyed your book. Perhaps we can start with your giving us a sense of how you got to studying the Middle East and Iraq in particular.
Okay, yeah. So I was in the U.S. Navy. I signed up right out of high school, I guess not really knowing what I was getting into, because I signed up in 1998 and then left in 1999, the summer of 1999. Obviously, it was a different world back then. The idea of going into a major war or into the Middle East just simply wasn't on the radar. But of course, things changed during my time in. And in 2003, I found myself on an amphibious assault ship with a bunch of Marines heading towards Iraq. For the invasion, I was part of a small intelligence collection team. I did signals intelligence that was sent to that ship. We worked out of a small van that was welded to the back of the deck. And the Marines went into Iraq with the initial invasion, and we were right there along the coast, seeing the shock and awe and all those sort of things going on around us. So obviously that left an impression on me. It also left me with a number of different questions. We came back that summer. My 4 years was up, and I transferred to the reserve, planning to just simply, I guess, move on with my life, leave it all behind. But it didn't really work out that way. It was sort of just kept nagging me in the background. I started studying the Middle East, studying more about it, but you know, going back there on my own, spending more time learning the languages, the history, culture, whatnot. And I began a PhD at Princeton in Near Eastern Studies in 2009. Just about the time, it was right around that time that two sets of Iraqi archives opened up. One was the state archives that were taken by the U.S. military in 2003. And the other was a set of files from the Ba'ath Party Secretariat, talking about something in the range of 10 million pages. Of Arabic files that were taken by Iraqi dissidents in 2003. And in 2009, both sets of these archives opened up. They were a sort of unprecedented source for Middle Eastern history, for recent Middle Eastern history. So it seemed to be fitting that I would dig in, and it all sort of came together. So that's what happened.
Well, Iraq is an experience that doesn't leave you very easily. In many ways, correct me if I'm wrong, but while your book is really a study of Iraq and how Saddam Hussein dealt with religion and harnessed it, it also is in a broader sense about religious legitimization of regimes.
Yes, that's right. When I began this project, I was really interested in Islamic intellectual history, the way it interplayed in modern politics, and I began looking into that, that subject in these Iraqi records. And what I realized fairly quickly was that there weren't really any good theories that sort of explained what I was seeing in the literature. There weren't good theories in the literature that explained what I was seeing in these records. So I had to sort of rethink what I was doing more broadly and rethink how states interact with religious leaders, with the religious landscapes of their country, with Islamic intellectual tradition. I guess there was a few things that in particular. One was just simply the idea or this strict divide that I think we have in the West, our Western scholars who study the Middle East, that divides very neatly, secular Arab nationalism and religious Islamism. And these lines are a lot blurrier than we often portray them. The religious leaders in Islamic groups often have Arab inclinations, Arab nationalist inclinations, as well as being Islamists. And secular nationalists like Saddam Hussein are often quite religious and, use their religion very publicly. They wear it on their sleeve. And it's a very important part of their ideology. The other thing that I noticed, sort of broader and theoretically, which applies to other states, is that the way that states or people like Saddam or regimes like the Baathist regime in Iraq use religion, the way they relate with the religious landscape, is different than how it's often explained. So normally it's explained that religious leaders sort of authoritarian leaders, non-democratic leaders reach out to the religious landscape out of weakness. So if they become too weak, they sort of have to make amends with the religious leaders, even if it's against their ideology. That's not what I found Saddam doing. Saddam didn't make amends with religious leaders on their terms, but on his terms. And he waited until he was strong enough to begin reaching out to them and begin co-opting those religious leaders and using religion in his ideology, which is something, I guess it's fundamentally different than the way it's most of the time is portrayed, at least in the Middle East. In the Middle East, it's often seen as religious leaders sort of acquiescing to, authoritarian leaders acquiescing to religious leaders. This wasn't the case in Iraq.
Right. I wonder whether you've at all done in writing the book, which you didn't work into the book, but may have done in terms of your research. In what way, for example, the way Saddam Hussein approached all of this differed from other countries where there was a very strict control of religion, like in Egypt or Turkey?
Yeah, so there are different cases, right? And Saddam Hussein, I think, is different than a number of places in terms of the way that he ruled, right? And I guess the best way to think about it is whether or not – so someone like Mubarak in Egypt, he really didn't try to compel religious leaders to take a certain view. He just wanted them not to say certain things, right? As long as they didn't cross a certain red line, they were okay, right? And, there was – the Muslim Brotherhood existed. It was illegal under Mubarak, but everyone knew who the Muslim Brotherhood leaders were. Everyone knew what mosques they were in, whatnot, right? There was no sort of attempt to present a different narrative about Islam and impose that on the religious landscape. I think that's changed under Sisi, right? Under Sisi now, they seem to be trying to do that in Egypt. And Saddam was a lot more like Sisi in that regard. He didn't tolerate differing opinions. He didn't tolerate different ideas. And he didn't simply have red lines, but he was compelling religious leaders to take a certain stance that was, or to adopt a certain narrative, a certain interpretation of Islam, which was a Ba'athist interpretation of Islam, right? So he wanted them to sort of buy into the idea that Islam is a kind of Arab religion, to downplay any kind of sectarian inclinations, and, you know, glorify the Ba'athist regime understanding of Islam, right? So this is different than maybe someone like Mubarak did. Now, it's often hard to understand how religious how different leaders around the region do this, because we just simply don't have the records, right? And in Iraq, we do. So there's sort of asymmetry there in trying to do a comparative study. But you can get the general outlines and see that, you know, in some cases, definitely there are, you know, political leaders who try to simply impose red lines that religious leaders can't cross. And in other cases, there are political leaders who try to impose a certain interpretation of Islam and make that the mandatory interpretation. I guess, you know, Turkey under Ataturk probably fell into the latter category with Saddam and Sisi, in that, you know, there were certain interpretations that simply weren't acceptable, and there were, you know, certain interpretations that were the right way. I think Iran probably falls in that category as well under the current regime.
I mean, in a lot of ways, that kind of control, which is what Saddam did, but what also the Turks have done and other countries do, is basically by dictating, if not the text of sermons, then in any case, the themes of sermons, or the parameters within which sermons have to, with which sermons have to comply. You see that now being implemented in Pakistan too.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's a lot more, and this is where I think the Iraqi record are revealing. Now, we don't know how much this is the extent in other cases, but I imagine it is. It's a lot more than simply saying, this is what you have to say, right? Because how do you know that they're actually going to say it? And how do you know, and then you get the problem of, if they say it in public, how do you know what they're going to say behind closed doors, right? What religious leaders are going to say behind closed doors. So you end up with this sort of spiraling authoritarianism or totalitarianism or whatever we're going to call it, where you have to not just have certain ideas that you impose on the religious landscape, but you have to alter the religious landscape. You have to make sure you have the right people in the mosques, the right type of religious leader who's willing to sort of toe the line. And you make sure that the wrong type of people aren't in there, right? So if you're trying to not just draw red lines, but actually impose a narrative about religion, you have to make sure that you have the right type of religious leader in the mosque. And this takes time, right? This, you have to sort of weed out the bad and put in the right people in the right places. And that can't be done immediately. That's a project that takes, you know, years, if not decades, to do. But it's critical if you're going to try to control narratives about religion in any country.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, obviously each country is different, and things are done in a specific way, but on more general terms, you know, a lot of this happens maybe not as forcefully and as imposed, or maybe not as harshly as things happened in Iraq, but you have, in a lot of countries, religious education, where religious officials, imams, and so forth, are trained, whether it's Hatip schools in Turkey or Al-Azhar in Cairo. And you have that whole discussion, of course, for example, in Europe, about training of imams so that they comply with a broader, more liberal culture. And so I'm wondering whether, you know, what we're talking about with Saddam is one specific application of that.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's probably right. You know, it comes with Saddam, you know, was well known for being, you know, quite a tyrant, you know, and he would use force more readily than a lot of other leaders. But I guess you're right. The basic concept is the same. And I think you're right. Hitting on religious education is the right way to do this. This is why it takes so long, because, you know, you really need to, if you really want to have people that, that are going to toe the line on your interpretation of religion, you have to find them early, and you have to train them and observe them over many years before you can, you know, trust them fully to do this. So it's not just about education, at least in Iraq, and I imagine in other places too. It's not just about education, but it's also about when you have control of these sort of seminaries, whether they are more traditional religious seminaries or if they are you know, universities that happen to have a sort of Islamic law faculty or something like that. You also control who gets into those faculties and who gets into these courses, which is very important too, because it lets you weed out certain people from certain backgrounds who simply won't be able to gain those credentials to present themselves as the sort of religious authority later on.
You framed your book and your writing of this history as the Ba'athification of the religion. And I sort of struggle with the term more because it's to me almost implies an ideological change, whereas we're dealing with texts that are multi-interpretable. So you can interpret them in sectarian ways, you can interpret them in non-sectarian ways, you can interpret them in more literal ways and in less literal ways. You know, because it seems to me that what this is really about is about political control and about getting out a message, in the case of Saddam, a non-sectarian message, a nationalist message, a message that's supportive of the regime. But it doesn't fundamentally change the ideology of the faith or the theology of the faith, but it more gives it one interpretation within a broad scala of possible interpretations.
Yeah, I guess, you know, you could put it that way. Now, the term Ba'athification isn't my term. That's a Ba'athist term that you find in the documents. Taba'ith is what they say in Arabic, and it's their sort of, you know, I guess if you want to call it a grand strategy towards ruling the country, that's what they describe as their strategy, which is, you know, to sort of impose Ba'athism and Ba'athist ideas on society, right, to Ba'athize the different social institutions of the country. And they do this, although they don't always use this term Ba'athification, Ethan, when dealing with the religious landscape. They basically do the same thing to the religious landscape that they're doing to other aspects of society, which is why I use the term, because that's how they themselves describe it. So, or, you know, that's how they understand what's going on. In some sense, you're right. There are different interpretations, right? There was never a unified, single interpretation of Islam, but the Ba'athists clearly have their own as well, and it's not an interpretation that was necessarily common. Especially, maybe it was popular in some sectors of society, but it wasn't sort of common among religious leaders to hold this Ba'athist view of the religion, which looked at it really as an Arab religion for the Arab people, not as a sort of universal religion. And it's an interpretation of the religion that downplayed large parts of what, you know, are typically part, you know, encompassed by different interpretations of Islam. So sectarian identities, you know, differences in theology or interpretation, it downplays, you know, most elements of Islamic law. So while, yes, it is one interpretation among many, it's certainly true that I would say, you know, as a non-Muslim, you know, I'm not here to judge one interpretation or the other, or say this one is right or that one is wrong. I would say it was probably an uncommon interpretation. And this type of bathification was used to make it into a sort of hegemonic, or to attempt to at least make this into a hegemonic understanding, that this became the standard, the norm for society. That was their project. And that was the project of bathification of religion, to take something that was maybe existing somewhere along the fringes and turn it into the dominant sort of normal understanding of Islam.
You at one point basically spoke about religion as being one of numerous social institutions, which of course it is. But I'm wondering whether in the case of certainly the Arab world and a fair number of non-Arab Muslim countries, in some ways Islam within those social institution takes on a special position, simply because it's something that a majority of the population adheres to, not only simply in terms of nominal identity, but in terms of daily practice in one way or another. And because Islam is so much, the legal code is so much a way of life, rather than simply do's and don'ts. And so in that sense, whether you're a secular Arab leader or a secular Muslim leader, Islam and religion is something you have to deal with and take into account and factor in how you do things and what you do in ways, for example, that Western secular governments and societies don't have to.
I think it's a difference. It's not a difference in kind, I would say, in the West, at least up until recently. Maybe now, these days, religion is playing a much smaller role, especially in Western Europe. But traditionally, I mean, if you look at the classic works on totalitarianism and authoritarianism in Europe, they all had to also deal with this religious issue. Now, I agree that this is something that's probably amplified in the Middle East. But it's a difference in scale as opposed to a difference in kind, at least from the mid-20th century and earlier in Europe. When the Soviets attempted to impose a sort of atheist ideology on Russia, they couldn't do it. It was really difficult for them to do. That was one of the most difficult parts of their project. The same with the Nazis. I mean, I have a few quotes in there in the beginning dealing with different type of regimes all over the world that had to confront this issue. And I think there's a few things about religion in general, which Islam certainly falls into this category, that make it difficult for authoritarian rulers. One, it's a different type of authority that's outside the scope of the state, right? So it's not political authority, it's a religious authority, and some people are going to follow religious authority, rather than political authority. This is a problem if you want to be the only game in town as an authoritarian ruler. Religion is often transnational as well, right? So there is no Treaty of Westphalia kind of thing, as there are for political leaders, right, where each state is sovereign and the laws are decided within those borders of that sovereign state. You could be in Iraq and your religious leadership is, the Ayatollah you're following is in Iran, right? So then it's very difficult for a political leader to sort of control what's going on in the neighboring state. This is the same thing that European leaders dealt with, right? So, you're in Poland, but the Pope is in Rome, and you have to deal with that somehow. And it's very difficult to deal with that because many of the tools in your toolkit simply don't work when you start talking in transnational terms, right? You can't simply arrest them. They're not in your country. So this causes all sorts of problems for authoritarian leaders. And I think it's no coincidence that, religion has been one of the more difficult issues for authoritarian leaders around the world. Now, this is, I think, particularly the case in the Middle East, as you mentioned, because Islam has traditionally played a much more prominent role in society, in politics. Islam, I would argue, while not want to be an essentialist here and say that it's necessarily has to be political, or that there is a sort of political interpretation of Islam that is right or dominant or anything like that. But there is a more robust political tradition within Islam than there are in several other religions. Islam has a lot more to say about politics than, say, Protestantism, Protestant Christianity. So, leaders in the Arab world and the Muslim world more generally have had to deal with this. And they've had to incorporate it into their ideologies in some ways. It's a central element, I would say, of basically any political ideology in the Middle East is going to be the religious question in a way that simply is not in the West.
And that's compounded, of course, by, particularly in the Middle East, by on the one hand, that as either various ideologies have failed to produce, or like in the case of Iran, the mosque was really the only one place where you could, to some degree, could speak out, where then religion sort of becomes, or religious institutions, whether those are religious leaders or specific mosques or, legal or underground, what becomes sort of institutions or vehicles of opposition or expression of dissent.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's not only in the Middle East. We think about, the Catholic Church in Poland, right? There's a number of other cases where we could talk about this outside the Middle East. But again, in the Middle East, it's been particularly pronounced, right? I can't really think of a Middle Eastern leader who ever wanted to present themselves as an opponent of Islam, right? Or an opponent of religion, at least in the Arab world, right? They usually bend over backwards to show that they are, good Muslims, even if Islam isn't the center of their ideology. It's a part of it in some ways, and they present themselves as believers. So you can't simply wipe out the religious landscape, right? You can't simply destroy the mosques or kill all the religious leaders, even if they are seen as a kind of opposition. So this gives religious leaders a little bit more power and a little bit more leeway, because there are limits to what the regime can do to them without, while still looking like they're themselves good Muslims, right? I think if most political leaders in the Middle East want to avoid any kind of image where they might be seen as anti-Islam or anti-religion. So this sort of boxes them in a little bit about, in terms of what they can do to deal with opposition in the mosques, which again, like you said, makes the mosques into, gives them a sort of unique status where they can be used by the opposition in a way that, say, like a trade union couldn't be.
Yeah, which goes to something that I really liked a lot in your book, which was your description of religion as being both an asset to the ruler as well as a threat. And, that's very analog. The only other thing that really compares with that is the role and the positioning of soccer or football in the Middle East, which is something I've written about extensively. Basically an institution that you cannot just simply shut down. You have to deal with it, and that has advantages, but it's also a continuous potential threat.
Yes, that's right. If you are a political leader in the Middle East, on one hand, if you can get people to believe that Islam is on your side, right? that to be a good Muslim, and to be religious, you have to sort of obey the political leader, and that this is legitimately, religiously legitimate political leadership that needs to be obeyed. That's a very powerful tool. On the other hand, you have to be careful, right? Because if you sort of present yourself as as a believer, and you discuss how important it is to be a believer and how important it is to be a good Muslim and all of these things, but you don't necessarily control the religious landscape of the country. Well, you know, you might have someone leave your speech and say, yes, it's very important to be a believer and to be a good Muslim. And they go to a mosque and they see a religious authority sitting up there, you know, Islamic authority. And that person says, well, this political leader we have is not a good Muslim. And actually, to be a good Muslim, you have to oppose this political leader. So in that sense, it can be very dangerous. So they're often put into this kind of structural dilemma, where on one hand, they want to use religion, it's very good, but they have to be very careful about how they do so, because it could blow up in their face, right? If the religious leadership of the country, the religious authorities in the country, sort of oppose them and say, yes, it is, he's right, being a religious leader, being, you know, religiously legitimate is very good, and it's essential, but he's not religiously legitimate, you know, this becomes very problematic. So many leaders in the Middle East, in Iraq in particular, which is what I spent, I think, most of the time in this book discussing, many of the political leaders spend a lot of time trying to control the religious landscape to make sure that that doesn't happen. If you want to use religion, if you want to use religion actively in your political ideology and you're an authoritarian leader, the most important thing to do, more than simply making the right speeches or you know, using the right terms, which is often what scholarship focuses on, Western scholarship, because that's what we have access to. More important than those speeches and that rhetoric is controlling the religious landscape of the country.
Which really takes us to another part of your book, where you talk about the evolving relationship, if you will, between Iraq and the regime in Iraq, and a Saudi form of religion, whether that being Wahhabism or Salafism, which in many ways served the regime's purpose up until the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990, primarily because one major school of thought within that more ultra-conservative interpretation of Islam was obedience to the ruler. But then, of course, when the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Iraq broke down because of the invasion of Kuwait, that very literal interpretation of Islam became a major target for Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis.
Yeah, that's right, to an extent. In the 1980s, there were a lot of Salafis or Wahhabis that supported Saddam, not so much because they supported Saddam, but because they hated Khomeini and they hated the Shis in Iran. And, you know, or they were sponsored by Saudi Arabia, who felt threatened by the Iranian regime and the Iranian revolution. And the Ba'athists had an interesting take on this. On one hand, they wanted their help. They needed their help, actually. And they liked all these bad things that they were saying about Iran, these Salafis. On the other hand, they were a bit worried oftentimes that these Salafis were going to be too sectarian, and they were going to sort of inflame sectarian tensions inside of Iraq, which would have been a disaster, or, you know, especially at that time, but at any time they would have been very problematic. But especially at that time, when you're fighting the Iran-Iraq war and, you know, most of your foot soldiers are Shis. So they took their support. They liked that they were getting support, but you see them discussing, you know, that they need to be careful allying with these groups. They have to make clear that, you know, Khomeini is bad and this Iranian Shiism is bad, but there is an authentic and legitimate Shiism that's practiced by Arab Iraqis, and they can't attack that. And you see not so much the international groups that are supporting Saddam during the war, but inside of Iraq, you see religious leaders who have maybe a more hardline inclination towards the Shi'is, having to skirt that line very carefully. You know, they'll bash Khomeini and bash, you know, everything about Shi'ism without actually saying Shi'ism. And then at some point say, well, and of course there is a legitimate Shi'ism that's practiced by our, you know, Iraqi Arab brothers here. And the regime was able to, you know, was willing to put up with that until, as you said, 1990, when it became, you know, clear that Saudi Arabia and by extension Wahhabis and Salafis were just an enemy at that point. And they had to do a lot of, as you call it, as a euphemism, housekeeping, you know, where they cleaned up a lot of these Salafi mosques. And they weeded out a lot of Salafi and Wahhabi leaders that had made their way into the sort of regime's institutions throughout the 1980s. They went through and sort of purged all those people in 1990, 1991.
As you were going through the Iraqi archives, did you see any discussion of how Salafis responded after 1990? Were they were there covert efforts by the Saudis, or was it the total, was the ability of the regime to cut them out fairly fairly absolute?
So it's interesting. No, the regime couldn't cut them out absolutely, and you know, these are documents of a authoritarian regime, so you have to read them in a certain way. They never say, "Oh, yes, of course, the Salafis are actually winning, or not just winning, but they're doing well, you know, and they're gaining in strength." You know, you won't hear them say that. But what you do see them doing in the 1990s is there's a lot more discussion of them having to fight Salafis and having to do anti-Wahhabi operations, and you know, the more they are discussing anti-Wahhabi operations, you sort of get the sense that they're doing that for a reason, and the reason is that Wahhabis are sort of gaining strength underground. There are instances where you see, you know, there's support by Saudi Arabia for these groups. At least the regime is alleging that, you know, in the records, right? They find tape recorders and sermons and things like this being smuggled across the border. You see religious leaders that take refuge in Saudi Arabia. You often find, you know, somebody, they're investigating somebody, and his brother was some sort of Wahhabi, and he took refuge in Saudi Arabia, and he's alleged to be, you know, financially helping his bill or something like that. You also see an increase in rhetoric, and I guess when they're training the Ba'athists in the 1990s, they're trying to tell them, you know, don't badmouth the Shi'is too much, right? Or not too much, not at all, right? So if we're going to do these operations against in the South, you know, we can't be using this anti-Shi sectarian language, which is often associated with Wahhabism or whatnot, right? Which tells you, on one hand, you know, the regime was against this type of sectarianism, but that it must have existed, right? If they felt the need to, to say it to their people, that means some of these people must have been doing this. So you can see in that sense that there is a sort of uptick in the 1990s on Wahhabi influences and Salafi influences in Iraq, even though the regime is trying to fight against it.
You mentioned Russian earlier, and if I recall correctly, you also talked a little bit about China, and you said, and you did that comparatively, saying that essentially it was a much narrower ideological gap in Iraq than it was in countries like Russia and China.
Yes, that's right. So, you know, obviously in Russia and the USSR, especially early on, and in Maoist China, right, in communist China, both of these countries are communist, and both of them were officially atheist, right? So they both had to come to terms with religious influences in their country, they both talk about it openly. Mao talks about it openly, and the Soviets talk about it openly. At first, when they come to power, they're going to simply eliminate religion. They find out that they can't do that. That's not, you know, the people just simply continue to believe what they're going to believe, and they, you know, they resist the regime, both regimes on those levels. So both of those regimes had to sort of fashion a version of religion that was somehow acceptable to them. You know, the Soviets, they had these, they were called Red Priest, which were a sort of weird organization that combined atheistic communism with Christianity in a way that they, you know, doesn't seem to make much sense, but that's what they did. But this was a sort of ideological concession by the regime to even acknowledge the importance of religion. For the Baathists, on the other hand, you know, since the beginning, they had religious components of their ideology. You know, even it's interesting. People assume that because the founder, one of the intellectual founders, at least of the Ba'ath Party, Michel Aflaq, was a Christian, that they must have been somehow ambivalent about Islam or even anti-Islam, which is completely not the case. I mean, Aflaq has a number of essays where he writes in the 1940s and 1950s about Islam and its role in the Ba'ath Party, and he understood Islam as being a central component of Arab culture, right, and of Arab society, and he looked at Muhammad as being a sort of Arab prophet that was preaching a message that was applicable to all Arabs, even Christians like himself. So the Baathists always had a positive view of Islam, and so when they came to power and they had to sort of make amends with the religious belief of the people, the gap that they had to, you know, any sort of ideological concessions they had to make were much smaller than some, you know, an atheistic regime like the Soviet Union would have to make. They might have had to, you know, smooth some edges here of their ideology to make it fit with the social realities of Iraq. They didn't have to wholesale change their ideology in any way to accommodate religious belief.
Another thing that struck me in your book was that you described what you do, I think, called an overlap between the way Saddam Hussein was trying to neutralize or harness religion and counter religious threats with either Western or Mao Zedong's counterinsurgency strategies. And in the Western case, particularly, you noted the French counterinsurgency strategist David Galula.
Yes, it's actually it's very interesting. You know, I actually teach now at the Navy War College's program at the Naval Postgraduate School, and you know, we teach about counterinsurgency at different times. And if you read the famous counterinsurgency manual that was created by Petraeus, you know, it talks about Galula, and you know, Galula is very central in this. But if you read Galula himself, he talks about Mao, right? He's talking about Mao. He's taking his ideas from Mao, which makes sense because that's where, you know, the French picked this counterinsurgency up when they were fighting in Indochina against Maoists. Or people who were being supported by the Chinese, right? So they sort of take those ideologies, turn them on their head, and try to, you know, use Maoism to, you know, to fight fire with fire, right? The American picks up on this. Now, of course, we can't, you know, an American doctrine, you know, doctrine that was talking about Mao wouldn't make much sense, right? It wouldn't make much sense. It just wouldn't be politically viable, right? This is not a winning combination if you're going to go to your superiors and say, we should do what Mao did, right, in the American military. But we do adopt a lot of Maoist ideas filtered through Galula, right? So that's sort of an interesting thing. Now, Saddam liked Mao, right? He used to quote Mao, the Iraqi counterinsurgency manuals, which we have now, you know, discuss Mao. They use Maoist thinking, fish and water. It was a famous, you know, Mao discussed counterinsurgents as fish and water, you know, society being the water and the insurgents being the fish, right? And Saddam used that in the same way that sort of Galula did, right? And by extension, the U.S. is, right? Which is that if you want to catch the insurgents, it's not about fighting them themselves. It's about, you know, transforming society, right? From the ground up, you know, depriving those fish of the water that they need to survive. Now, the U.S. and Saddam Hussein carried out this idea very differently, right? But it's interesting that it was actually based on a lot of the same ideas. So when Saddam wanted to was dealing with insurgents, as he was many times during his presidency, he used this Maoist ideas, which was to get rid of the context in which insurgents can operate, right? So you have to control the religious landscape, you have to control the religious institutions, and you sort of deprive any kind of religiously motivated insurgents from the water that they need to survive and to thrive. When the U.S. adopted its counterinsurgency plan under Petraeus in 2006, it did a lot of the same things, not as violently, you know, not even close to what Saddam did, but the theory was the same, right? That you need to basically create a society and create a social context in which insurgents can't operate. So it's a sort of strange, ironic overlap, I guess, that, you know, when the U.S. was applying this counterinsurgency idea, they were applying a lot of the same ideas that Saddam had applied, and they were both getting their ideas from Mao.
I want to come back to the beginning of our conversation and, in a sense, to how you got into all of this. You also describe in some detail how when the United States invaded Iraq in 2003 and effectively took over the governing of the country, they simply didn't have the kind of infrastructure that Saddam Hussein had built or the intelligence to deal with religion.
Yes, that's right. I mean, when the U.S. took over Iraq, there was a number of assumptions. It seems to me, and you know, obviously, a lot of this is going to have to be played out once U.S. archives from this time open up. But at least from the outside, from what it looks like, the U.S. had a lot of assumptions going into 2003 about Iraq and about the nature of state society relations in Iraq. That turned out to be false. The idea that Saddam was simply a tyrant who wasn't really exerting any sort of social control, they had lost control over large sections of the population in Iraq, turns out to be false, I think. If you look in the Iraqi archives, he was exerting control, and he had intelligence officers and Ba'athists on the ground in very robust ways, and that's how he was ruling the country. And when the U.S. went in, the idea was, well, Saddam isn't really exerting any social control. So if we just knock him off, then, you know, we can also just rule kind of from the top down without having to exert any kind of social control, because society is already kind of there at an equilibrium without outside pressures on it. That turned out not to be the case, because Saddam was exerting social control through his intelligence officers and security officers on the ground and through the Ba'ath Party. And when the U.S. went in, it simply didn't have that. And this was very disruptive. It was impossible, I think, in hindsight, for the U.S. to rule without having people on the ground. I don't know what the solution would have been, but that's just simply to, you know, I mean, not people on the ground, people really integrated into Iraqi social institutions like religion, right? To understand what was happening in the mosques. Because Saddam, you know, especially during the 1990s, as I mentioned earlier, they were constantly having to fight sort of what you call, you know, radical organizations that were trying to infiltrate these mosques, whether it be Salafi some sort of militant jihadis. There was also Iranian groups that were coming in to the south and trying to penetrate to Shi'i mosques, right? And Saddam knew what was going on, and he had intelligence agents in place, and he could spot these people and weed them out right away, neutralize them right away. The U.S. simply didn't have that, right? So if somebody got up and started saying all sorts of radical things, violent things, you know, the U.S. didn't even know it was happening, let alone having someone there to go and be able to stop it.
The American notion that Saddam didn't have control, was that in any way influenced by events in 1991 when the Americans forced Iraqi troops out of Kuwait? And then there was a moment where it seemed that President George W. Bush at the time was encouraging a revolt, and you had the Shiite uprising, which subsequently was squashed. But that notion that the moment you loosen the control, suddenly this opposition and explodes, and therefore there was no social control really.
Yeah, yes, I think it was partly due to that, and partly due to the repercussions of that, or the events that came out of that, which were that there were a lot of Shi'i exiles that were organizing in places like London and in some sense, you know, the United States, and they were trying to gain favor with Western regimes, right, to come to their aid and to help them. And they presented a narrative of themselves. They presented a narrative of the regime as being very sectarian, but also of not having any sort of influence or control or being completely illegitimate among especially the Shi'i populations in the South. So this narrative, I think, sort of took hold, right? Because the regime wasn't really letting people in to do real research in Iraq on the ground. Right. Most people speak to reporters, right, or academics. But this Shi'i opposition, which did have a certain, I would say, narrative that wasn't necessarily wasn't correct. It wasn't a good narrative of the regime having lost control. They were very influential in shaping Western ideas about Iraq and American ideas about Iraq, because that narrative was very useful for them. But I think it turns out to be wrong.
Sam, we could go on for quite some time yet, but we've taken up a lot of your time already. What I'd like to ask you finally is, where do you go from now? What are you working on?
So I'm going to stay working with these Iraqi records. I just find it fascinating to sort of look behind the curtain. I found when I was doing research on this issue of religion in Iraq, I found an interesting organization in the records, which no one has really written about or even knows it exists, I think, outside of, you know, people who are actually in the regime. It was called the Iraqi Ba'ath Party Outside of Iraq. It changed its name several times over the years. But it was generally an organization that was set up to control and to manipulate and to instrumentalize politically the Iraqi diaspora around the world. As the diaspora is sort of exploding or ballooning in different places across Europe and America throughout the 1980s and 1990s, the regime sets up branches of the Iraqi Ba'ath Party in different countries around the world. So there's actually 69 different countries where they do this. So it's quite extensive. And they try to sort of replicate the authoritarian structures that they have in Iraq in other places, you know, use violence, but also carrots and sticks, right? So also giving money to people and giving help to people to get Iraqis in the diaspora to sort of do the right things according to what the regime thinks are the right things. And those right things are to help them, you know, get their message out, propaganda, spy on other Iraqis, you know, spy, give general information about the states and societies that they that they live in. And I find a lot of, well, it's just fascinating to see how this works on a sort of international, transnational landscape, right? It's sort of authoritarianism outside of the borders of a state, which is interesting. But it's also, I think, more relevant to sort of broader trends in politics that we see today from places like Russia or China, which are trying to use their diasporas, especially China, to achieve political goals, right? To get their message out, to infiltrate certain parts of different societies. And it's a really difficult tale, I think, especially for a lot of Iraqis, and I imagine by extension, Chinese or Russians or whoever else, who think they're leaving a regime behind, and want to sort of move on with their lives and integrate into their new societies and be productive members of society. And they still are within reach of these regimes. And these regimes can reach out and touch them in very violent ways, not only for them, but they're for their families, home. So, and it's something that's not really discussed, especially now since the Arab Spring broke out, there's been a number of refugees, from the Arab world that have made their way to Europe, and not many, unfortunately, to the United States, but, made their way around the world. And we mostly discuss where, we worry that there might be terrorists, or we worry, on one hand, there's people who worry about that, from the security aspect, and there are other people who worry about it from the humanitarian aspect. There's people who are drowning in these boats or whatnot. But after they get to whatever country they're going to and they sort of settle in, we generally forget about them. But regimes like Saddam's don't forget about them. And I doubt that if Assad stays in power, that he's going to forget about them. And they have means to reach out to these people and to try to control them, manipulate them in ways that are politically beneficial for the home regime. And it's something that really hasn't received enough attention. And I think it's very interesting. So I've spent the last few years, I guess, starting to dig through the files on this Iraqi Ba'ath Party outside of the United States, to see where it fits in the larger political history of Iraq during this period, right? Broader, because they played a central role in Saddam's strategies to sort of break the sanctions down in the 1990s, to break out of the isolation that was sort of imposed on them diplomatically and economically following the Gulf War. So, there's a lot there. I'm not sure exactly where I'm going to take it yet, but that's the direction I'm moving.
No, indeed. As you were speaking, I was thinking of the United Front in China, which is very active in trying to counter certain Chinese groups, but on the other hand, enlist Chinese diaspora and ethnic Chinese communities as lobbyists and supporters of the regime. In any case, it sounds like a fascinating project. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it and wish you all the best and good luck.
All right, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being on.